Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Bear Boat Alaska, a pure DIY hunting game with one of their 37-foot adventure yachts. You and five of your friends can hunt, fish, set crab pots, shrimp pots, and take DIY to the next level. Bear Boat Alaska is locally owned by a Ketchikan resident who lives here year-round. Call Larry at 907-617-4542 or go to bearboatalaska.com. That's B-A-R-E. boatalaska.com and tell Larry you heard about it on this podcast.
I had a good solid hit with the guy they ever booked. Two. I've had a couple.
Yeah.
But then I got a guy coming back that came last in the spring and got a bear. And then wants to come back and go duck hunting.
Oh, nice. That's good.
So, I didn't really think that was a thing. But
so. People are looking at to do a whole bunch of different stuff. I know when I was in California, there was duck season and there was a public land area that you had to go to, and it was like a race to get out to the good blind because the other ones were just terrible. So I think people who like to do that stuff are strapped for opportunities.
Yeah. Right.
Unless you have, you know, all the money to be a part of one of those clubs.
Right.
Where it's $5,000 to be a part of it so that you can.
On private land.
Yeah, so that you can book your $500 weekend or whatever it is. So, yeah, I think people want to come up here and have the experience for ducks too. So, back here with Larry Jackson, that was our intro.
That was
our one-minute intro. We're just rolling.
Oh, we're hot. We're coming in hot.
Do you miss guiding out of Knutson Cove at all? You miss being on this end?
So, I did that for almost 20 seasons. Mostly cruise ship stuff, you know, and we can see where we'd fish right out here. And, you know, it becomes a little bit of a Disneyland, you know, ride. It's the same kind of thing every day. And then, so then the pandemic come along, they shut down the cruise ships. And so it was a little bit of a shock at first, but then I like, wow, I like this. Yeah. I like not having the, you know, you get into a routine of it. You have the same shtick and spiel every day. You know what, you know, and the one thing you do is you see, man, the progression of fish through the season because you're out there every day. So that said, I guess I kind of miss, maybe I should say it this way, I miss the money, but I don't miss the the actual, I took a few charters this year just with some local friends and stuff, and after I got about 10 pinks, I was ready to throw the towel in because it's a little bit of a deja vu.
Yeah.
Moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's my long answer to a short question.
Yeah. Yeah. Living at the south part of town now, we're talking off air just about how it kind of feels like fall down there because you don't see as many fishing boats. People are kind of cruising past every once in a while. But up here at the north, we're looking at 10, 15 boats that are all trolling for cohos. This is kind of the hot time for that. And it's also the Derby weekend. So it's kind of interesting to...
Yeah, it's gotten known here over the last 10, 15 years or longer that there's these silvers going by here. And so the Knuts or the Clover Pass rental fleet is out there. The lodges are all full. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a really ideal bare boat situation because, you know, it's deep. It's pretty forgiving. It's fairly sheltered from, and it's close. I mean, the people don't have to run that far. From both aspects, the renting side to the you know, the person doing the overseeing of the rentals, you know, it's got a lot of pros to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, yeah, I mean, it's ideal. Of course, as we mentioned before, it's kind of a subsubsidized fishery in the terms of it being mostly hatchery fish.
How much have you seen change over the years? Because obviously, when I first moved back here, and I grew up on Prince of Wales, and so there was the King Salmon Derby that was for May and June, and then July and August, and you tend to see a lot of good kings in May, June, and then July and August were some of your bigger kings, but there weren't quite as many around. This derby used to be a King Salmon Derby.
Oh, yeah. So, and it was the, it started on, this is Labor Day weekend. It was the opposite. It started on Memorial Day weekend at the end of May. And you're right. We had these, well, starting in the 50s or whenever the, it was a Chamber of Commerce King Salmon Derby. So, yes, it's changed now. We don't even have that. In part, that is mostly because the king salmon, wild king salmon stocks that come out of those mainland river systems, the Unic River, the Chickaman River, those stocks have just been in decline. And they are yearly up there with biologists and the Stikine River too. They're all, they monitor those stocks. And they just have not been able to get them to come back for whatever reason. So they eventually here just a few years ago said, oh, we're not even opening up for kings until June 15th, which I think allowed the wild fish to go by here mm-hmm. to try and get them back into those big rivers. And then mostly the kings you're catching after the 15th are hatchery mm-hmm. fish. So that's kind of the main change. So, you know, that's unfortunate, but hopefully it works. But there's still a little bit of mystery why some of those hatchery stocks survive, but the mainland river stocks haven't.
Yeah, that's such a tough thing to look at. People want to blame one specific thing, but it's a little bit of everything, and a little bit of everything that then chips away at the whole, at people want to blame just charter fishermen. They want to blame just commercial. It's like, well, there's a lot.
Well, I've heard people blame the commercial fishing of herring stocks, you know, mm-hmm. but it, you know, on its face, I don't think any of those things particularly hold. And I'm not a biologist. They probably have a better sense of it than I do. But, you know, there's obviously enough herring out there to support these other critters, from whales to sea lions to silver salmon, mm-hmm. you know, and some people say there's an inverse to survival to the temperatures in the North Pacific and the health of the, you know, the Gulf of Alaska and North Pacific to the survival of fish. So, but that doesn't particularly explain those particular mainland king runs.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, who knows why? And maybe those fish are just more. There's a tipping point on a stock survival too, you know, where they can't get them over a certain threshold to then rebuild that genetic diversity and that volume of survival, you know, cause you, I think there's, I don't remember what the statistic is, but you know, of the, there's probably only 5%, I think, that survive.
Yeah. It's real low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you think about that, if you have some wild king spawn on the Unic River and you get, let's say you get 50,000 spawn, well, what's 5% of 50,000 at 2,500?
It's not much.
Yeah. And then they get caught, some of those get caught along the way and, you know, maybe commercially and sport wise, maybe you're down to 200 to 500 that might make it in the river. Is mm-hmm. that really enough?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you start doing the math on that, and you think it's amazing that there's anything left at this point.
Yeah, well, I thought about that too. When you look at, if you actually go out here and look down that shoreline of Benton that we're looking staring at, and you'll see this. It looks like an armada.
Yeah,
you know?
It's crazy.
And you think, well, how in the heck does a fish get by here? But it's remarkable how. Same with commercial fishing. You know, you think, oh my God, they purseine's out there. They're going to kill them all. No, these fish go under, around. They yeah. come from different times. They come from different angles. You know, so these guys are all fishing over here. Hell, there's probably a whole pile of fish on the other side over there.
Yeah.
You know, that
was when Abby and I were fishing this last year about this time when we had the boat. just launching after school, going out there for a couple hours and try to get, you know, two, three, whatever. Yeah. But there was always, all right, should we go across to Valner? Because maybe that's where they're really at, you know, or maybe the bite's not there and it's...
Or they're offshore a little bit.
Offshore a little
or
bit.
Or they're on the Cleveland Peninsula side, you know.
Yeah, there's... yeah. It was pretty fun. How long have you lived in this house? And in that time, how much change have you seen as far as the King salmon fishing fleet, the silver fishing fleet, the kayaking, all that stuff, and the DIY movement, the bear boat movement? How has that all changed?
Well, I think, you know, originally, it you know, Clover Pass was one of the original resorts right around the corner here. And it was all skiffs. Everybody fished out of a 16-foot smoker craft or Lund or whatever. And what you're seeing is as there's more and more these self-guided operations, lodge operations, you know, us, the Chinook Shores are next to us here. Throw a little shout out to them.
They have some great little boats.
Yeah, well, the wealth of the boats, the number and size, and that's all increased. You know, even Clover Pass, which I said had started out with skiffs back in the 70s or whatever, 60s. Well, now they have these covered, aluminum Thunder Jets or whatever the make is. I can't remember the make of their boat. But so you got more comfort. You know, you go from these open skiffs to maybe a little sheltered boat. And then I think the same thing's happened in the charter fleet to a certain degree.
Yeah.
You know, so you got more wealth in there. And, you know, so then you get a certain level of volume of, you know, there weren't a lot of people. There were nobody doing these little things like we do with two or three boats, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You had Knutson Cove. You had maybe Clover Pass. And then, maybe a lodger like the Silver King Lodge start, you know, these guys are 20, 30 years old. Used to be you'd fly out to different lodges, you know. And even those lodges, I was a kid, our family friends are the ones that started Waterfall Resort.
Okay.
They converted it from a cannery to a lodge in the mid-70s. And that was all skiffs.
Yeah. Their latest iteration has gone from kind of a smaller, more efficient, fuel-efficient boat to North Rivers.
Yeah.
And they have 40-some.
Is that how many they have out there now?
It's crazy being over there. And I remember growing up on Prince of Wales.
So it's all self-guided in big
North Rivers? No, those are all guided. I don't think there's any self-guided ones. But still just the, you know, if they have to make a pretty long run to get to those areas. But growing up on Prince of Wales, everyone had fiberglass, bayliners, things like trophies.
Glass plies.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then when I started coming back during the summer, started to see kind of the evolution to aluminum and started seeing these lodges and some of the local places would have, you know, a boat and then a bed and breakfast type thing.
Yeah.
And then you had the big lodges, Fireweed Lodge had fiberglass boats and they switched to a smaller, fuel efficient, low profile that was good to troll, didn't catch the wind. But you know, they had 9 boats. That was pretty big.
So yeah.
To see Waterfall have to buy 30 or 40
millions of dollars worth of
crazy amounts. Yeah. And they've expanded to Steamboat Bay. Now they have that little cannery there too. So it's just,
right.
I can't even do the math. I don't even want to do the math. It just makes me,
And I think like everywhere there's a lot of pressure. There'll be a lot of pressure to exert, you know, there's no limitation particularly on bear boat, and they are looking at some. The Board of Fish is looking at maybe changing the retention on self-guided. You know, if you're guided, you have certain limitations, especially on ground fish, bottom fish. Whereas in unguided, you can keep the same. So I think you're going to start to see probably some changes there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that'll affect. As long as the money's coming, the boat stuff would probably just get better and better.
Yeah. You know? That's the one thing I haven't seen a lot of on Prince of Wales is the self-guided fleet.
Well, and I think it goes back to what I pointed out at the very beginning. Look at the convenience of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's close, protected, and fairly easy to manage. But let's say you try to, you know those grounds out there better than I do, but you have to run a self-guided guy and try to direct him out to, we have limitations on where our boats can go just because from an operator's point of view, you think, well, if my guy is over there and he has a problem, I have to go find him and help him out or whatever. You don't want him at Cape Shacken. Well, the other problem is that you have the variable weather. And a lot of people don't get how quickly things can go from bad to worse. So yeah. My group this morning went to pup and it was too rough for them. And they left and they went back up Clover Pass to find a nicer place because they're just not used to fishing in these conditions. So.
Yeah, that's the thing about the outer part of Prince of Wales. There's a lot of different islands, but it's all on that outside. And so sometimes you can tuck back inside and you can get some fish, but then there's, on the way back in, you're hitting a couple of really exposed channels and bays, whereas here, you're tucked in pretty nice.
Yeah, there's also lots of things to hit.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is rocks, logs, and so forth. So the further you run, the more you add a kind of factor of, incompetence that can create problems. Yeah. So, like I said, it's a little bit of a sweet spot. You don't see it in Juneau either, the self-guided thing. Now, you do see it a little bit on those lodges in Wrangell Narrows. They have some unguided skiff fishing out of there that seems pretty popular. You don't see it so much in Sitka because I think it's the similar fact that the good fishing is out off the Cape there, and it's a couple hour run, and it can be treacherous.
Yeah,
you don't want to just let anyone go out there. And, when you were so respectful and cautious when you started fishing around here, and I remember you talking to me about it. You're like, what should I do here? Or where should I go?
Yeah.
And until you get scared a couple of times, you don't really realize how bad it can be.
I was always trying to reduce it down to I could look at the weather forecast and I could say, as long as it's lower than this, if the wind direction is this and it's this, then I could go and it was all good to go. But then I learned very quickly that might make the waters really good for trolling right here around Survey or Pup or something like that. Mm-hmm. But then, if you hit the tide wrong or you're over at, you're trying to go across, like it's going to be a totally different, you get around Valner and it's totally different.
Oh yeah.
And the wind changes and then, you hit it at a different tide. And I don't know if I became, it almost seems like I became more cautious. The more experience I have, cause I had that 15-foot Boston Whaler and made a run down to Thorn Arm to hunt, which is pretty exposed. And once you kind of get around, I don't know where that island is in the middle.
Bold Island.
Yeah, there, Bold Island. It really starts to funnel in, especially if you've got tide. But, it's glass calm coming out. On the way back, there was a little bit of chop. But overnighted, did the little anchor thing, pushed it out there, and had the line on the anchor. So you pushed it out and pulled the line, and then the anchor falls in the water. And then made a run up to Traders with Abby, and she was holding on to the rails.
And you're death-defying.
And I thought she was having fun because she's kind of an adventurous person, but she said, no, I was praying the whole time because there was hardly any freeboard. Two and a half footers with an occasional three in there, but man, if you're in a 15-foot boat, that's
a lot of water.
That's pretty big. And so, like, you can steer into them and you can be on the gas if you need to, but you just can't turn, and that's the big problem.
I don't know if I told this story already on this podcast, but I had a group one time over there at Camino. You can see it from where we're sitting, right? And that Camino is like a convergence of three or four different main bodies of water: Clarence Strait, Beam Canal, Kassan, Tongass Narrows. Anyway, so they anchored up over there, beautiful, calm day, whatever, and then the tide changed. So it's flooding, let's say. Then the wind picked up. And it went from nothing to like a 3 to 4 foot chop. And they got back here and they literally laid down on the dock. And of course it was bright, sunny, warm, and calm right here. But they're like, they were just, grateful to be back tied to the dock.
You're hitting all that broadside. I mean, that makes such a difference when you're rolling on it. Yeah,
it gets mixed.
I was really surprised the first time. I've only been back to the Eunuch once. But being back there and just the backside of the Beam Canal, plus all the water coming out of the Eunuch and the Chickaman, it was crazy to be that tucked back in there, to have the weather or have the water moving so much and be so bad. But as soon as you got, down the north part of of the beam, then it was fine again. But man, it was coming up the backside of that pretty crazy. So you learn a lot of that stuff and you feel more confident. But it's
in a good way that, it's great that we have this setting. I think as a economic engine, shall we say, you have this setting where people can come from, you know, all over the planet, really, and enjoy a little bit of catching fish in the wild. They even enjoy the rain. You know, today the guys are from Denver. It's so hot, you know, summer, and they're like, oh, God, this is great. You know, they get to see a whale occasionally. And really, the impact is pretty minimal. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they're even catching these hatchery fish. So, you know, and this has been coming since the, you know, these cruise ships started coming and so forth. You could see that this, what I would call an extended stay kind of visitor industry was going to develop. And I foresee it'll probably keep going.
Yeah. Is that Kirk Deal that just went by in that skiff?
Does he have one like that?
Yeah, he's got the industrial.
Yeah.
Aluminum, that thing is sweet. We came back from, or he and I came back on from book club on that once. And that thing that thing is an awesome.
Well, like Sean McAllister has one too, the Pacific Skiff.
Yeah, those are awesome. Yeah. But Abby and I, not having a boat, have been thinking about when we get back into the game.
Yeah, what do you want to get?
Know, what do we want? Because we had the skiff and then upgraded to the 21 foot soft top North River, which was awesome. It was so great. But then as soon as we got that one, it was, if we had a hard top, you put a raft up there, put kayaks up there. So it wasn't what we wanted. Do we spend the money to put
a bathroom?
Yeah, it's just, so now that we're totally out of the game, we're thinking, all right, do we want to just get back in the game, get a skiff and then do that? Or should we just save and get the boat that we want? It's
the classic dilemma, you know. Yeah. Of course, you know, you look across to that guy there's a Seawolf. They're all welded. Do you want an all welded aluminum with a hard top? And then you got to have a bigger engine. Then you have all that goes with a bigger engine, a bigger trailer, you know, more place to park. That, well, I saw this when I was a teenager, where I built the boat. Then I had to have a trailer for the boat. Then I had to have a truck for the trailer. Then I had to have new tires for the truck. And then, you know, it's just this snowballing effect.
And then you got to use it.
Yeah.
Because if you don't use it, then you spend all the money on that and...
Yeah, it's, that's where, you know, renters like me come in. You know, this guy, a friend and associate of mine, finally came back to this area, and he was like, well, I want to buy a boat, you know. And he went through this exasperating detailed investigation to find a boat. And he did all this exhaustive research, and finally he comes down to it, and he's like, one of the mechanics said, don't buy that boat. And he's let go of this particular boat. But I said, you're a lot more money ahead if you're only going to use your boat a few times a year to rent.
Yeah. Speaking of don't buy that boat, there's a skiff that just went by. Yeah. It's definitely a modified job. It's probably 18-foot, 20-foot Lund.
Yep.
And it's got...
canvas enclosure.
Yeah. A welded front. I don't think it's a walkthrough, but it's got a couple windows, and then it's got a canvas top. Some of those... And you see them on places where you can buy boats, buy, sell, trade, and whatnot. And they've modified these boats into where I get a little nervous about
stability,
how it's going to sit. Yeah. Have you read, what's that book? It's about the mysterious sinking of the Arctic Rose. And they took an old crab boat and they had tried to modify
Sandia's Rose?
Ooh.
Was it that? It was a crabber?
I think it was the Arctic Rose. It was one of those where they'd modified it either from like a tender to a crab boat or back and forth. And the modifications that were made on it made the boat so unstable. Mm-hmm. That's probably why it went down, because there was no trace of it.
Well, I have personal experience with this. Do you know that story?
Oh, maybe.
I was on a Perth Seiner, the Baranof Queen, that capsized.
Oh.
Back in 94 or 5, somewhere in there. And it was because we modified it. And it was, the boat is still in Ketchikan. You see it downtown. It's incredible how little amount of weight up high on a boat will make it unstable. And we had just, and I say we, I didn't own the boat. I was a deckhand, but the owner, we put some new rigging on, like a new boom and a picking boom. And, you know, it had a bigger net than those boats were originally designed for, with more weight, bigger skiff. So all that stuff is on this boat up high, and it's running around without water in the tank. I think when the water's in the tank, it was perfectly stable, but we had no water in the tank and the autopilot failed. It's a long, laborious, fun story that probably we don't have time for now. But anyway, everyone survived, but the boat rolled over.
In waves? Were you making?
No, we were in flat, calm water. The autopilot malfunctioned. And when they do that, they have what they call rudder feedback. The rudder feedback came off. The autopilot doesn't know where the rudder is, and it just turns the boat hard over. Turn it hard over. We're going full speed, and it just flopped on its side. And I walked out one window with the skipper up to the keel as it rolled over. I never went in the water. The other two guys did go in the water. We got them out of the water, and eventually, you know, not soon after that, another boat spotted us and picked us up. But the boat actually never sank. It just floated there, and the whole story is the whole saga of refloating it. And anyway, so that's all a stability thing that you're right to be cautious about.
Jeez.
And just people, if you just put a bunch of people
on
a boat that's not you know, it's not designed for, just the weight of people can cause problems.
Rick Collins always sends me reels on Instagram about people, like the qualified captain, I think is the name of it, or boating fails or something like that. And there's so many horrible ones. Like the docking ones make me uncomfortable and kind of laugh. The trailering boats kind of makes me laugh, but it's the people who are, you know, just plowing through waves.
Oh yeah, those river outlets.
Oh, with people
in the bows.
Oh my gosh, it's horrible. And just taking on so much, or people jumping off the bow to get in the water and just.
Or I have a very, we know of a kid in our history here when I was a youth that fell off the bow as he was going full speed and went under the boat and was hit and killed actually. So that's that thing on YouTube is, it's a little shout out. You can delete it if you want. It's called Boneheaded Boaters of the Week.
Boneheaded Boaters of the Week?
Yeah, right. And it's just a guy that does this. You can send him your clip of somebody doing something stupid. Now, that said, I'm just going to cover my arse. Everyone's done something dumb on a boat before. So, but, you know, if you can learn from your your boneheadedness.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like the intent of satirical websites is to mock for the purpose of bringing about some sort of change where you see the stupidity and think, oh man, I didn't even know this was a stupid thing. But now I get this great example of what's the worst case scenario. So,
kids, I yell at them, Nick, we'll be in the skiff going somewhere and they want to hang over the bow. No, you can sit up there, but you cannot hang off. And then I used to have a rule when I crabbed alone, I never went to the bow when the boat was in motion. Mm. I would only go up to set the anchor if it was just in neutral, you know, or whatever, or had to do something. I would never run, you know, crab my rig around up there while the boat, because if you fall in, you're done.
Yeah. What about shooting chucks, things like that? That was another thing about going up to Traders. Abby and I, we shot through, the tide was perfect. And
but
so
you had it timed, right?
Oh, yeah, it was perfect, timed through. And then we went to check it out, and because there's a delay between what the tide says and the water's going to be moving through the chuck, and so we had to wait a little bit longer than I had anticipated until, because it's like a river. It's like a full-on river coming through.
Not only that, it's a waterfall when it's low tide.
Yeah.
You can't go through it.
No. So we kind of hung out a little bit. Beautiful day, so tried a little fishing back there, but looked around, set a couple crab pots, and then I waited probably a good half hour past when I thought it was safe, just because I didn't want it to be marginal. I wanted it to be pretty good, and I just gave it some gas and was able to ease on through that pretty easily. But you could feel like the little waggle of the
It's like a river. And then you know, I think in a planing hole you're a little bit safer in the sense that you can kind of get on top of everything there, but I always go through in, you know, my displacement holes, so I'm very cautious. I just basically have a blanket statement to my rental people that they don't go in there at any, even if they think they can. So because there's just too many variables. Mm-hmm. If you don't read the tide right, or if you're not sure there's a rock on the left going in, I use the stay to the right, these kind of things. And one time I went around there and there's a dang snag that had fallen. It might still be there. And, you know, if you come around there and get tangled up in that thing. But, you know, I think, like all things, if you're cautious and you know how to read a tide table,
then, you know, it's fine.
Yeah. But it's really nice, too, that there are some apps that you can download that give you a better picture of the where things are. And you can have it on the phone. So you have the tide table, you have, you know, when it happens, and some of these will work when you don't have cell reception either. And so it kind of gives you an idea of how much of the little bay or inlet drains out to. I think
on Navionics, there's a West Coast tide table, and they actually have the different tide, stations, should we say.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular app, you can take and you can actually use your finger and move you can see the flow rate, you know, the highs and lows, the slack water times and so forth. It's basically a big sine wave of the currents and the tide levels. So
here's someone with a lot of frame of reference. We'll go to maybe two little topics there. First one, technology when it comes to fishing. Does it make for better anglers now, or do anglers now use it as a crutch? And that could be with tide tables, could be with GPS, with all those sort of things. Has it prevented fishing?
I think the one thing the modern transducers are good, and the charts that show what they call fishing charts, they show you the contours like a topographical map. You know, it used to be the NOAA charts were all, you know, soundings that they took 50 years or 100 years ago, you know, and they gave you a general outline of the contour of the bottom. Well, now with these nuanced topographical style charting programs, you kind of see, wow, oh, look, there's a little ledge there I never really noticed. For bottom fishing, I find it really particularly helpful. As far as seeing fish, like, I'm sure there's people have taken advantage of this chirp and what they would call sonar.
Mm-hmm.
Stop it off.
No, we're good.
Sonar application where you could see like a school of fish to the left.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. I don't know. Most people are not going to be able to take advantage of that at all.
Yeah.
I don't even explain it to them. But my bigger fear, at least our overnight extended day cruising boats, is they depend on the chart plotter without knowing how to use a radar.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in a low visibility situation.
Like right now. Fuck. In the last 10 minutes, it's just moving in right now.
And I just talked to a sea pilot about this the other day. People in their own little world see they're on their little chart, blah, 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 blah. Meanwhile, they have a massive cruise ship bearing down on them, not even being able to see it or know how to get out of its way because they don't, you know, of course, radar is real-time representation of the terrain and boats around you. The chart plotter is a representation and shows you on there, and it can even be off based on the GPS, you know, positioning. So on the most part, the chart plotters are fairly accurate, but I've seen it where I'm on land. I don't know, you probably you know, where the vessel's not where it is in relationship to the real shore. So that's my biggest fear, and I try to reiterate it to people. You cannot depend on this in a low visibility setting.
Yeah.
So we don't have a lot of fog around here. Actually, this summer was probably the most I've seen in a while. But so, you know, if you're in places where there's like chronic fog, like in the Bay Area or something like that, I'd be really worried about people not knowing how to use a radar.
Yeah. I've talked about it with some other people on the podcast about what technology has done to hunting and hiking around. You know, we rely on where we're at, following that blue track that we're making on our phones. But, you know, if we lose the phone, break the phone or whatever, would we be able to get back to where we need to be? And
what do you think?
I think it's, like you said, it's a crutch. It's the same sort of thing. Like, I grew up on Prince of Wales, and so you kind of know not to, if you get turned around, I know that things are going to be, it's a thick forest, things are going to look weird, it's going to be really, really dense, and so that initial panic that people experience and that claustrophobia that leads them to do, you know, a crazy thing of just running in one direction or something like that, and they get really, really lost. I'm used to the thickness of the forest.
Yeah.
So if I do get turned around, I don't panic. I can be like, all right, well, let me think here. If you do get a glimpse of part of a mountain or something, or or happen to, you know, hear a float plane or see a little bit of water, you think, okay, well, this is the water on this side. This must be this. And so I need to go this way. But yeah, I think people who don't have a lot of experience outside that just rely on that, they're totally helpless. I had a buddy who was helping out with search and rescue in Wyoming. And rather than assume people would go down to try to find roads, or go out of this drainage. If you go out of this, just down out of here, this drainage eventually leads to the road. That sort of common sense doesn't necessarily make sense to people. And so they're climbing up mountains to try to get cell phone service.
Oh, wow.
So their reaction is not...
Okay, counterintuitive.
Yeah, I'm in this bowl. So if I head out of this bowl, I'll meet a road or I'll meet this river and I'll be fine.
I think that's usually... I've been lost one time on a fairly bucolic hike. That it was my thinking that got me lost, not the terrain that got me lost. I didn't want to go downhill, so I actually went around the top of the mountain one time and came right back to my spot. I'm like, oh, you're just trying to follow a ridge that isn't here.
Yeah.
And so then I had to kind of back myself out of my brain. And I think that what you're saying is people, their thinking gets them lost, not the actual terrain.
Yeah. And that's happened to me too. I'm so worried about, okay, I got to stay right. Because if I go left, then, you know, stay right. So then you end up going too far right.
Yeah.
You know, but then you can kind of check and you can figure some stuff out. And also knowing just kind of how it feels. But I think, yeah, we are woodsmanship skills.
You know who would be good to have a whole podcast on that with McAllister, one of the guys from KVRS. Because they find people in all these situations. There's that guy that went up just this summer with his son up the Lunch Creek Trail, right? He got up there and realized he couldn't find the trail to go back down. And see, he eventually called and they went and got him. But he was cold. It was late. It got dark. Yeah. You know, that kind of thing. So,
well, yeah, that happens. There were a couple of those. There was one a couple of years ago where a little boy was left out there and passed away.
Yeah, yeah, that was tragic.
There was one off Deer Mountain where they, you know, they assumed that, and this is, have you read Lawrence Gonzalez, I think? It's Deep Survival. It's what happens psychologically to people when they're in stressful situations. And they were talking about... Navy aviators who were trying to land on aircraft carriers at night in storms.
Okay.
And how there can be alarms that are going off that say that the approach is wrong, and so they have to abort. But sometimes the pilot gets such narrow tunnel vision that they think that's safety. I need to land right there, that they ignore the red
alarm.
It says, no, your approach is not right. Yes, there is safe, but the approach isn't right. So unless you abort and go around, you're going to crash. And they'd kind of alluded, not to the book, of course, but one of the people that was coming down Deer Mountain and where they went off, they could probably see the lights of Ketchikan, but that's not where the trail is.
Right.
That's the shortest. It seems to be the safest. It's right there. It's so close.
I just go straight towards them. I'll be fine.
Yeah. And that's, that's.
Yeah. There's cliffs all over up there.
So a less sad topic, maybe going on to technology when it comes to fishing, specifically rods, reels, lures. Prince of Wales is a lot more just the cut plug mooching program, whereas over here there's a lot more trolling. Scents, things like that. What have you witnessed over the years that's really actually helped?
I think that I think it's the tackle industry has just gone crazy. The amount of stuff that you see in the hardware on the tackle store now with the colors of hotspot flashers and all. I mean, my sister is a perfect example. She goes out in her Lund skiff with a lead weight and a cut plug and catches as much fish as the next person. And it's the same thing they were doing 40 years over at Clover Pass in the Lund skiff. Mm-hmm. And then you have guys like me that are buying all these different color flashies, flashers, different color hoochies, and, you know, on and on and on. And you go, well, okay.
Yeah.
Is it really necessarily? Probably not. And I don't know about the thing here that's really probably made a difference is the downriggers. You know, downriggers have just metamorphized into these really nice things that they didn't used to be. And, you know, you go, you have electric downriggers now, and fairly reliable, even though I cuss them regularly. You know, in the last 25, 30 years, those have really gone from, you know, lead weight trolling to, and I have a bunch of people that like to use those Dipsy divers or those diving type apparatuses, which I personally hate, but they love them for whatever reason. And, you know, it works. People, and I've caught quite a few of them because people out of skiffs that don't have downriggers use those divers. So their gear, they don't know where their gear is. Their gear is way off to the side of them. They go by you. I've caught, you catch them on your downriggers, cables, you know. So I don't know. It's probably just like everything. Humans love bright, shiny things. So we buy it, you know?
Yeah. When I was in, living in California, and I picked up, I think it was salmon and steelhead journal. And so I was just kind of flipping through, and they're doing king salmon fishing in a buoy 10 or whatever that is in Oregon. And I was looking at the rig and I thought, wait, what is this? There was, you know, this much line to a swivel. And then you have a bead, and then to this, and your first thing, and then another leader to this, which is your this. There was like five or six different pieces of plastic, and then you finally had your hook. And I'm thinking, man, yeah, it's that's not what we do over on Prince of Wales. Like, how complicated do you have to make it? I think, too, and I again, I saw this in California, was there was a Bass Pro Shops. Once the Bass Pro Shop came in, you know, during your shopping season, that's your, you know, November, December, January, February, March. You have all these months where you can just look at stuff. And you can go to Bass Pro and you can look around and think, man, that might actually be pretty cool, make a difference. So I think there's part of it. And I did that. I would go there and say, I'm going to use this when I go back home to because maybe it will be better when probably not. But, you know, shopping season.
My cousin, who is out using one of my boats right now, swears by black coochies and, you know, cut plug. But then I told him, Mike, I don't think it matters for the most part. I've used green and, you know, you put a twinkle skirt, a little bit of scent on there, and you're, you know. I mean, I try to explain to my guests daily that the way those hot spots are designed is they're designed to roll, and then they make the hoochie. That's one thing I notice about people not quite understanding the mechanics of things was the hot spot rolls and it makes the hoochie dart. So the longer your leader, the less it darts. Shorter your leader, the more it darts. So if you want a lot of action, you shorten your leader up. You don't want less action, you make it longer. And then a lot of times I see people put hoochies behind like spinning dodgers or flashers. They're just designed to spin real fast and reflect light. They don't actually roll. And so they're not really designed to have a hoochie behind them. Although people catch them that way, and everything. The guys were telling me that mostly you put herring behind them or some kind of a herring setup. So I see that mistake made quite a bit. But then again, somebody goes out there. The joke on me was my first day charter fishing out here in '99. I went out there. I had my hot spots on backwards. I went out there, caught like three kings my first day ever guiding.
Nice.
And I came back and Daryl Welk walked by the boat because he was fishing over here then, and he's like, and the guest had already left, and he pulled me aside. He said, "Do you know you have your flashers on backwards?" I'm like, okay.
I've done that too, and that's the funny that you can get dialed into a program. This is how I run things. There's something about it wrong, but if it's been successful, and you do it and you fish with confidence, then it can end up being right. And it's like, dude, why would anybody do this right now? This doesn't make any sort of sense. It's like the person who, you know, who matches the hatch when they're fly fishing.
Yeah,
they get the exact same size everything. Like, this is the exact size, shade, everything of what's actually hatching. And then someone else just throws out a streamer, you know, and there it goes. But it's...
Well, you know, what you do notice as a guy that's fished for years is what you do is you kind of pare down your complexity, and you get what works for the situation you're in. So people are always horrified when they get on my charter boat and they go to use one of my poles and my drag is like super tight. Well, when you're catching a pink salmon, you don't need all this loose drag stuff. You're not, I mean, because really what would happen is everybody would, you get a fish on, you'd hand them the pole. If the drags were loose, they sit there and reel fast, and they're not really gaining on the fish because it's so loose. So then what happens is the especially on kings, even you want a fairly tight drag, in my opinion, because you have to get the slack out after it releases off the the downrigger clip. Well, what happens is people be reeling and not gaining on any line and not taking up the slack, and the fish is just wagging his head and waving goodbye. And so, you know, there's that kind of thing. And you know, so I dial in. I use all this heavy leader because you're catching a lot of fish. And you don't want your leaders breaking. These production tide leaders will often fray and break apart in no time. So you use a heavy gauge leader. I go to a single hook. The reason you use a single hook is because you catch a lot of shakers and you want to release them. You don't want to kill them. So they're easy to release. Or if you get into the season where you get a bunch of pinks and you don't want to keep all your pinks, it's easier to release them with a single hook. You use, you know, a little bit bait, maybe strip bait versus going – like my guests that are here, they're going to fish cut plugs because they don't care about their bait budget. They're just going to throw cut plugs at them all day long.
Yeah.
Whereas I would never do that as a guide because I'm too cheap.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing too. Like if you don't have the right action on the cut plug, after a while, if you've been trolling for a while, and this is our problem, we have to check the bait over on Prince Wells. If you get a little bit of a jellyfish on there,
anything on there,
it's not going to work. Or after a while, if it's been spinning and you've been, even when you're mooching, you can tear out the whole little bit, so you don't have the right stuff. So you got to check the bait a lot. But yeah, I think that's what everybody can catch fish, and then your tiers are developed by the people who consistently do things well. And if conditions aren't good, they still get fish.
I'm going to throw a bone to Collins right now, because that guy, when he was fishing out here in the cruise ship fleet, he caught kings. He was really good, and he had a particular way he rigged his herring that he outfished me all the time, and he just knew how to do it and liked to do it that way, and I had a different way. I still caught some fish. It wasn't like I didn't, but he would probably double. And there's other guys that are just, well, they have a system and they do well at it, but there's other days when you get into your rhythm and you're stuck, your gear's working and there's not, you know.
Yeah, thing. That was Abby and I were just starting to figure some stuff out, and it seemed like if we fished, at least it worked last year. Sometimes it could be year in, year out, but we were fishing deeper and it was keeping the pinks off. We weren't getting as many shakers, and so when other people were just sorting through pinks by fishing deeper, it seemed like we had kind of solved that, and it was good to start feeling that.
Oh, you discovered every guide's trick now.
Yeah. I know. You just start to feel like, hey, I got something figured out, and it feels good. And then you put more years into that. And if the next year doesn't work, you find that middle ground. Or was it the depth? Was it what we were fishing? What was it, you know, was it where we were fishing? If we were out a little bit further, whatever.
Oh,
so
yeah,
you start to put all that sort of stuff together.
What it does is now you've created your preferred thing. You've caught a few pinks, you're not done with that, you're trying to catch a coho or two or a king. And I used to do that because, you know, there's these guys going out. I fished around these guys for 20 years. So you go out there and you think, well, really, do we really, I've actually seen people on a charter get bored catching pink salmon. When you're on your 15th and you've already lost, you know, another 5 to 10.
Yeah, they all look the same.
They all look the same. And they're like, well, okay, you know, maybe we should try to catch something else. Well, so what, you know, you do is you fish people, not fish. That's the way I say it. So you'll say, okay, these guys, you know, they're happy with 10 fish. Let's put this gold king spoon down at 110. Let that thing wander around down there for 3 or 4 hours. And every now and then, bang, something happens. I had a situation when I took this group of, I think they might have been Koreans or whatever, and we're fishing over in Blank Islands, and it's middle of summer sometimes. So it was kind of past king salmon season, and so I'd thrown the herring down at 110 kind of to not catch pinks on it thing, you know, and it's just wandering around down. I kind of forgot about it over there. And we were up to like, oh, this was a group, to back up the story a little bit. When I negotiated with them on the dock, they said, yeah, we want a bargain. You know, we want a break because we got 6 people. I said, okay, you know, I'll do it for $100 a head or something like that. And they're like, oh, you're way too high, you're way too high. I'm like, no. You know, so anyway, he says, okay, we'll do $100 a head, but we want you guarantees fish. I said, well, oof. Okay, guaranteed fish. Oh, I knew there was fish, so, but I kind of played it cool. I said, okay, I'll guarantee you one fish per person, but for everyone over that, I want an extra $10.
Nice.
Okay. So we go out there. We got to the 7th fish. $10. And I yell that real loud and I throw it in the cooler.
Nice.
You know, and so every time a fish came over the rail, $10. Anyway, so back to my the thing, we're trolling along. We were up to like 19 fish. Okay.
Nice.
Know? This king rod goes off. And, you know, as a guide, you know, that wasn't a pink.
Yeah.
That thing. And then my kind of standards. If it's taking drag, because I set my drags real tight, if it's taking drag, it's a king.
Yeah.
So this is on. It is a group reeling. All five of these guys are around this guy, and he's all across the back deck reeling in this king salmon. They get it in. It's a beautiful king. They're ecstatic, you know, blah, blah, blah. So we're going back to town. I said, here's the form to get the fish processed. They're like, oh, we don't want the fish. I'm like, what am I going to do with 19? I think I had like 16 pinks, 2 silvers, a chum, and a king, you know, that kind of thing.
Funny. Yeah. Like, well, it's some different cultures. My brother and I were in Guam. The program was you take your guided tour out there and you catch fish, but then all the fish get, you know, no one keeps the fish.
Oh, yeah.
And so you go back to the dock and then people show up and it's kind of like the donation to the fish market and the people sell it and that's part of their lifestyle. The person that comes down, the kid comes and cuts it. And then, you know, that's how they make some of the money back. And the guy was almost offended that we wanted to keep the fish. Well, we paid money. We want to eat this stuff.
Yeah, it's a different
cultural experience. Well,
although I get quite a few over the years people that want to give you the fish thinking you can sell it. And you have to try to explain to them, you can't. Because I think in Florida you can, maybe Texas.
Interesting.
You can sell sport caught fish. Here, obviously, there's a distinction from sport to commercial. So what I did for years, and back to the guy that... The Koreans, I talked to the Thomases. They were great. They filleted and processed the fish, and then we donated it to the senior lunch program.
Mm-hmm.
So
nice. By the way, did you happen to see when that gray charter boat was heading out there and caught real close to that kayaker that was coming in by that marker there?
Gets to be a little bit of what I would call angst between the two.
Yeah.
Because you see the charter or the kayaks, and they're all friends. I know them all. I know the family that owns that, the kayak business. And I know the charter guys. Well, they start to get irritated that they have to keep driving around these kayaks, you know? And so then they cut through, you know, and of course, look, the kayaks are spread out of a quarter mile.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, where do I go?
Here, yeah. You know? That first one he was trying to like cut the corner quick to beat the kayakers,
right.
But then that first kayaker was kind of like the lead group, and it was like, well, let's get in front. Yeah, that was, you don't know how close it was because
advantage. I know that's Andrew. I could see the boat from here. Yeah, anyway, we'll show.
No, it was, they're already gone.
Yeah.
Now it's a pretty wide thing, and for the most part, they kind of stayed each other's way, but this last little bit here, you have to be in front. So
I think what I've noticed over the course of the years is that, you know, first, everybody's pretty amicable. Come mid July to August, everybody starts to get irritable because they've been accommodating tourists and biting their tongue. And then they start to snip at each other.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the different guides get on each other's nerves. And then they get they got to be irritated with somebody, so they get irritated at the kayaks, you know.
Yeah.
We've had lots of run-ins over the years. As guides, this is a whole nother nuance out here. It's like its own little ball field, you know, a playground, should we say. Whereas we have all these self-guided people now that are out there in their little rentals, and they have no concept of the protocol of trolling. So they'll cut across to you, or they cut across what we call the drag, and the drag might be a certain loop rotation, you know, counterclockwise or whatever. And they go across. I've actually run into, and I say that kind of mildly, we bumped boats with these little Livingstons, you know, and nobody's ever heard. It's such a slow, it's like a slow collision, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it tempers flare, that's for sure.
Yeah. And there's kind of what to do also when you hook up. Like if you think that you hook up and then, you know,
you and all the water around you.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah. And then other people, you know, it's like, okay, this person's got a fish on. Things are a little bit chaotic. Maybe I'm going to move a little bit.
Get out of the way.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
We're getting up on an hour, and I got to go pick up Abby. God. She's walking around Ward Lake.
Oh, yeah. She should be done by now.
So, yeah.
Well,
but, thanks again for being on.
I don't know if it doesn't feel like we focused on much, but it was a lot of babbling.
No, I think we got some good stuff.
good.
We got some good stuff about fishing. I think we got some good stuff about some history, some interesting observations. I think that's why people listen.
Thanks, Jeff. It was fun.
Thanks again for being on. Appreciate it.
Okay.